Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Second Half, 40 Women Reveal Life After 50, by Ellen Warner. Foreword by Erica Jong. Afterword by Sarah Lamb. Narrated by Hannah Choi, Zira Jane Nakui, and Carmen Jewel Jones. Publisher's Note. Ellen Warner's photographs of the women chronicled in this audiobook can be found in the print and ebook version of this book. Foreword, Erica Jong. I've often thought that portraiture was kinder to women than the photography that replaced it. Photography flatters the bony, not the fleshy. Photography can be cruel. But paradoxically, these photographs and interviews by Ellen Warner demonstrate that women can be handsome and arresting at every stage of life. When we see their expressions as they become marked by time, we experience wisdom that is inspiring. We read their faces as if they were stories. Photography usually shows us the magic of youth, which is no challenge. We are surrounded by photographs of the young and beautiful. Here, we are asked to find beauty in experience. Everybody has a story to tell. What makes this book unique is the empathy the listener feels after learning what these women have overcome and what they look forward to in their second half of life. Ellen Warner has found women with stories so moving that they teach us. The common link between these very different women is their strength. I grew up in a family of portrait painters and almost became one myself. So I am in love with the way the faces of aging women change and grow. Studying expressions leads us to admire them. Faces reflect the struggles and joys of lives, the subtle turn of a lip, the gentle slope of a brow, the confidence of direct eye contact. Acceptance of how time changes us is, after all, the ultimate wisdom. To live is to change, though change is never easy. These faces hint at the stories that the women have lived through. Warner's interviews cut straight to the heart of what makes these women so special. The bravery and resilience of Odette Walling, surviving a traumatic childhood only to face war, imprisonment, and torture, and her ability to still find love and motherhood. Jean Angel's ambitious career choice in studying law as a woman at a time when women were expected to stay home, and how the isolation she dealt with prepared her, perhaps, for her future struggles with ALS and the enormity of choosing whether to live or die. Women from the Middle East pursuing education, or women from Europe and Australia embracing and creating jobs for themselves that no one was giving out. Each story defines how choices lead to consequences that reap both reward and heartache. Each woman shows how she survived both and shares advice. When I was growing up with a grandfather who was a portrait painter, I became aware of light and shadow and what facial expressions tell us about a person. I remain fascinated by the revelation an artist is able to make that showcases the personality of his or her model, knowing the exact expression or pose that makes the person unique or compelling. Isolating the way that the light emphasizes certain features and understanding the way a person's expression transforms them. That Ellen Warner chose to use black and white photography for this book is in itself an art form. She admits that choosing the women for this book was not about beauty, but about finding faces and stories that were captivating. As a writer, I create character through action, description, and dialogue. For the photographer, the challenge is to show personality in a moment. Who are these women, and what questions should be asked to get them to reveal their stories? How do the details of each background give insight to the life of the woman posing in it? What Ellen Warner has done is observe the beauty of older women and give a whole person in a moment's flash. The interviews that accompany each photograph further enrich the pictures as you put a face to the protagonist of each struggle and success. You come to know these women by imagining what they are thinking. You are given not only words, but also light and shadow, composition and form. How do you catch the personality of a woman wearing a hijab? By the way she stands, The way she positions her head and hands, her attention to the camera, her confident gaze tells you everything. My mother, like my grandfather, also painted portraits and took pleasure in painting her children, and later grandchildren, as they were sleeping. Perhaps because children can't sit still to pose, or perhaps because all sleeping children look angelic. Regardless, I admire these paintings because they captured a moment and allow these moments to live forever. Much like these photographs, beautifully composed, Warner is gifting us and these women with a moment that showcases strength and beauty that transcends time. When I am photographed, I have to force myself to relax and remember that I can't control the outcome. I think the fear of being photographed is the fear of losing control. The more you can forget the outcome, the better the photo will be. I love photographs where you feel that the subject is completely free and unconscious of the photographer. I rarely like photographs of myself, but I try to give up control because I know we don't see ourselves clearly. There is no doubt that photography has changed the way we see women. From magazine covers and advertisements, commercial photography has made it rare to see women as they truly are, growing older. Women past the age of 50 don't live in pajamas and water plants in their slippers. Well, maybe sometimes. But the reality is that women past the age of 50 have usually shifted their responsibilities from finding partners, forging careers, and raising children to reaping the rewards of reciprocated love, friendships, hard work, and eventually, grandchildren. The second half of life that Ellen Warner refers to is seen in the portraits of these women who understand what life encompasses. No longer fresh-faced beauties waiting to discover what lies ahead, their beauty lies in grace and understanding. These women know of pain from labor, be it childbirth or long hours at work. They also need the sweetness of a hand to hold and the warmth of a hug. Looking at these images, you think that these women aren't worried about hairdos or shades of lipstick. These are women who know how to run their fingers through the earth to plant tomatoes, women who taught their children how to knead dough and bake, how to watch clouds passing by, and how to appreciate the colors of sunset. These women take pride in their heritage and cultures, showing backdrops of their environments, sometimes scattered with sculptures or rustic farm fences and apple trees. They share experiences of love and loss and learning. We need to celebrate women not for wrinkles, but for laugh lines. We need to see ourselves changing and growing. If that means looking older, celebrate it. Experience is as beautiful as youth. These pictures are meant to teach us that every stage of life has its own enchantment. Introduction. Ellen Warner. In 2003, I first went to Patmos, a Greek island that I fell in love with and now return to every year. The way I get to know a place is to take portraits of the people who live there. 15 years ago, I asked Jacqueline Delia Bremon, a beautiful French woman who had been coming to Patmos for 35 years, if I could photograph her. She had just turned 70, and while I was taking her portrait, I asked her what it felt like to be 70. I found myself listening attentively, not in the abstract way I usually do when talking to a subject while really focusing on the composition of the picture. I had been thinking about aging myself. "This is what I want to know," I thought. What does it feel like to be 70, 80, or 100 years old? How will I feel when I lose my looks or my ability to be independent, to travel alone to remote parts of the world? What is it like to know that the end of life is approaching? And that was the birth of the second half. I've spent my career taking pictures. Interviewing was new to me. I had to decide what questions to ask. What did I really want to know? I narrowed my questions to the following. How would you describe the second half, i.e., life after 50? What did you learn in the first half that's been helpful in the second? How do you feel you've changed, including your interests, values, and your sense of who you are? What used to give you the greatest pleasure? What gives you the greatest pleasure now? What was your happiest time? Your saddest time? How do you look to the future? How would you like to be remembered? What advice would you give younger women? After several interviews, I decided that the audience needed to know more about the women. What kind of family were they born into? What had their childhood been like? So I began to start each interview by asking the woman to tell me her life story, starting from the beginning. People often ask me how I found the women in the book. The answer is, usually through other women. Shortly after that trip to Patmos, my husband and I were invited to visit friends in Paris. I was chatting with our next-door neighbor across our garden wall, wondering how I would find women. "You must photograph the woman who is married to my husband's uncle," my friend said. That was Odette Walling. Our hosts in Paris recommended a few women, and Jacqueline Delia recommended others. On another trip, walking down a little street in the village of Ubud in Bali, I saw a beautiful woman. "Who is she?" I asked my companion. "She's my auntie," was the response. That was Niketut Tekil. I was later told that in local villages, it's customary to call every older woman an auntie. In southern Algeria, I was crossing the desert with 5 friends to visit the prehistoric paintings of the Tassili. I asked our Berber guides if they could keep their eyes open for a nomadic woman, which is how I met Fatma Dauphin. In general, I had 2 criteria for the women I photographed and interviewed. They had to be interesting-looking, not necessarily beautiful, but interesting-looking. And they had to be willing to open up and be honest in the interview. And, with a couple of exceptions, I didn't want to photograph friends. I wanted to approach each person with fresh eyes and ears. I looked for diversity, both geographic and socioeconomic, within the limits of how much of the world I could cover. When the women couldn't speak English, they had friends, and in one case a granddaughter, translate. I asked very personal questions during each interview, and I wondered if the granddaughter learned intimate things about her grandmother that she might never have known. While everyone told me her age at the time of our interview, I've used circa, abbreviated as CA, when I don't know for certain the specific year when someone was born. Some interviews were very long, and then I had to edit a great deal, an agonizing process, as I found everything about each woman's life story compelling. Each woman has taught me something. I've learned about running a pub in London, arranged marriages in Saudi Arabia, shoeing racehorses, raising a son to become a world-famous cellist, and much, much more. The women have been inspirational. I will never forget the courage of Jean Angel, who could only move her eyeballs and depended on others for care. Her ability to adapt and still lead a vibrant life, attending ballet performances and art exhibits, using her legal mind to help her wide circle of friends and family, made me forget she had a disability. Or Lali Al-Balushi, whose husband divorced her in Oman and moved with her 3 small children, the youngest 2 months old, to Pakistan. Now, small annoyances aren't so important to me. Because this project took 15 years to complete, circumstances for some of the women in the book have changed since they were interviewed. Tamison Day Lewis, whom I interviewed early in the project, shortly after she was divorced, is now happily remarried. And a few of the women, including Olivia de Havilland, have died. Each woman's interview and photograph is a moment in time, how they felt then, as honestly as they could relate it. Their lives span a century, and their attitudes express their time and culture. One of the things I found interesting is that the nomad in the Sahara and the cook in South Carolina often come to the same conclusion as the Marquesa in Seville. There is a definite consensus, which was surprising to me at first, that the second half is better than the first. "This sounds like turning lemons into lemonade," said an American friend of mine in her 40s, but I found it voiced with real conviction. In the second half, you know who you are, and you are liberated by not caring about what others think of you. In the second half, wisdom kicks in, intuition takes over, and you can accept yourself, flaws and all, with greater ease and clarity. That very positive message became the underlying theme of the second half. I would like to express my gratitude to the women in the book, who have taken the time to be included and in many cases have reflected upon unpleasant memories. I trust their stories will be as helpful to listeners as they ponder difficult decisions or moments in their own lives as they have been to me.
Odette Walling, born 1920, interviewed at age 86. Resistance leader, Ravensbrück prisoner, 47321. King's Medal for Courage, Amadei de la Resistance, Paris, France. Each day and each moment changes your feeling about the second half. You get a nice phone call, the sun is there. You get a nasty phone call, and you are all alone. I haven't changed at all as I've gotten older. I've always been extremely faithful to friends, but very intolerant if they behave badly, and I do not easily forget. My father died when I was very young. His lungs had been burned by the German gas at the Marne. He had become a socialist and was anti-army. I had been very close to my father. I adored him. When I had whooping cough, he was the only one who could give me the medicine. It smelled like ether. Even if he came back at 10 p.m, I was not asleep. I took that horrible medicine only if he gave it to me. The saddest time of my life was when no one told me my father was dead. I saw a box they couldn't fit into the house. I thought it was very funny. Then we went into the cemetery, and the box was there. The box went into the ground, and I was given a purple bouquet, and there was a nun who smelled of bad soap. She hated me as much as I hated her. The nun said, "You are a very bad girl. You don't want to throw your flower to your father." I then realized my father was dead. I ran from that nun, jumping from tombstone to tombstone. I was 4 years old. I had a lonely childhood, as my father was dead and my mother remarried. My stepfather was a total bore. I grew up alone with a small dog. We had a black maid and a deaf gardener. I was totally different from the other children in school, with good English shoes, which I threw away one day into the sewer. My mother didn't understand. I don't think my mother was made to be a mother. At 18, I legally became an adult and got a small apartment on the Quai Voltaire. I had a little pension from my father. I went to medical school, but on Saturday nights and Sunday mornings, I answered telephones for a company. The war started when I was 19. When I was 21, Hitler came to Paris. I was stuck at the hospital where I was working. For 2.5 days, I couldn't get home. You couldn't cross the street. I spoke to some Jewish people who had no money to run away. I managed to take the little boy to the non-occupied zone. Then I went to see a British friend of my father's who was head of the resistance. I went by myself to Switzerland. I became chief of the area from the Belgian border to the tip of Brittany. I had another name. I cannot tell it because I was responsible for the death of some Germans. I could be in danger still. We followed the Germans everywhere, and I told my men what was happening. I had fake papers, and I pretended to be a social worker going to big cities to see how children and pregnant women were doing with no food. François, my childhood friend, was caught. He was tortured and he collapsed. He spoke, so they came to arrest me. I was in Amiens. That was in 1944. In Amiens, they woke me practically every night. They had mock executions all the time. They would put a gun to my head and tell me that if I didn't talk, they would shoot. I didn't talk. They didn't shoot. I wanted them to shoot me, but they did not. They put me under water to make me talk. I've never again put my head under water. I was interrogated by that German friend of Hitler's. I came back after being tortured and lay flat on my pallet. I was lying on my stomach because my back was so sore. There was an old German who had been in World War I, and he would sneak in to see me. He gave me cigarettes and patted me. And he said in German, Oh my God, Kinder. Oh my God, you are so brave. He would have gotten into terrible trouble if they discovered that he came to me. His name was Gideon. He was a farmer growing apples. There were 2 to 3 weeks when we were in quarantine. Then we went east. We stopped in camps where they were torturing men, making them jump on nails. Then we arrived at Ravensbrück. During my time in Ravensbrück, I spent 5 days in a coma in the snow, 30 below zero, nude in some rotten bamboo thing full of people who were dying. I was left for dead. It made me lose my kidney. I was punished to walk for a month in shit up to my knees and to shovel it. We had no soap, little water, not even a towel. Then, in August, it was so hot. I thought of throwing myself on the electric wire. We were up at 3 a.m. to a bowl of dirty water. You go out without a coat in all weather and stand until sunrise. You could hear the women falling. Puff, puff, puff. Then you carried, without food, a 50-kilo bag with the dogs after you. I loved dogs. They could sense it. I was never attacked by one. We saw train after train of women and children arriving from Poland and further east, little girls in the snow. I was beaten terribly because I gave them my bread. I still have the smell of the incineration. My mother didn't know where I was. I don't wear any of my decorations, and I don't want to have the big pension I should have. I didn't do it for that. 2 years or so after the war, I met my husband, who was working in Paris. We got married in Rome 3 times in 1 day, once in Italian, once at the French embassy, and once at the American embassy because he was American. The Americans were shocked that I didn't want to take American citizenship. I was 29 or 30 when I got married, and Christopher was born a little over a year later. He was premature because I had one kidney not working. When Christopher was 5 years old, we moved to Cape Cod and lived in Wellfleet. We had a few years of happiness, and then it was over. His father left us when Christopher was 13. He said to me, "If you ever remarry, I will kill myself. If you take a lover, I will kill myself." When Christopher was 21, he allowed himself to be bought by his father and didn't see me for 3 years. All I knew of him were postcards. I have very few friends, but good friends, but now they are all dying. I am not afraid of dying. I am tired. I am not religious. I don't want to go to an old officer's place to die. Old people are so ugly when they are in a group. I've always been a very lonely person. I read a lot, a bit of everything, in English and in French. I'm used to being alone. Seeing my son Christopher gives me the greatest pleasure. I spend a lot of time in bed. I take care of people I hardly know with little money. Simone Weil's older sister by 3 years is my closest friend. I met her outside Paris. We were prisoners together, kept in an old fortress, built by Vauban. She had been caught in Lyon. I met her when we were both naked in the showers, the first time I'd had a shower in a month. We telephone every day. She is like my sister, though 5 years younger than I am. They didn't think she was Jewish. She has blonde hair. She lost her whole family in Auschwitz. I hope I won't live too long. My advice to younger women is to accept that you are getting older. Nothing is more annoying than women who want to play 20 years old when they are aging. One has to age gracefully. It isn't always easy.
Jean Angel. Born 1944, interviewed at age 65. Lawyer with Lou Gehrig's disease. Prout's Neck, Maine, USA. My second half is so different from the first that they seem to almost not belong together. My first half was busy in the extreme, and my second half has been limited to enforced tranquility. The first half was full of work, family, and so many activities. In the second half, most of that has been stripped away, leaving relationships with family and friends. But I have searched to understand the ways that what I learned through experience has informed my ability to deal with an extreme and debilitating illness. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, but most of my close relatives lived in New York. I was drawn to the East Coast and went to Wellesley College, but the culture of the early 1960s, where job opportunities were extremely limited and women were not viewed as successful unless they landed a husband, was stultifying. I wanted more. I was passionate about civil rights and issues of the poor. I decided to go to law school immediately after college. What a change from Wellesley. The debate was lively, the issues fascinating, but it was a world that had not really changed. The often asked question was, what were 28 women doing in a class of 550 men at Harvard Law School? It bred in us the desire to show that we belonged there, that we were not just taking men's rightful places, and that we would accomplish things. After law school, I went to work at a large law firm. Although Harvard Law hadn't had many other women, there were some. But at my law firm, I was the only woman lawyer. Unlike other starting lawyers, I was given a closet of an office all to myself because the powers that be thought male associates would be uncomfortable sharing an office with a woman. None of the men's eating clubs permitted women in their dining rooms at lunch. I would often be the only woman in the room in large restaurants. I came to Wall Street just before the Vietnam War and the social revolution of the 1960s opened the doors of law schools to women, and subsequently to the law firms, which had so resolutely resisted hiring them before. I went to work in the Trusts and Estates Department, though I had reservations about being placed where women often were. Even so, I enjoyed working with individual clients, helping them understand what problems they faced and finding creative solutions to those problems that met their needs. Managing a demanding career was not enough for me. Women of my generation wanted what their mothers had, a husband, children, a home. One was supposed to manage both complicated parts of life effortlessly without sacrificing either. Just trying to create that seamless impression was a task, and it left little room for personal space. But I wasn't willing to give up anything. I loved my work, adored my husband and children, relished my homes, planned interesting travel holidays, and joined not-for-profit boards. I couldn't think far ahead. I managed day by day. Then, suddenly, my world was turned upside down by a devastating diagnosis. When I was 53, without warning, my body literally slowed down. I couldn't walk fast anymore, and when I tried, I fell down with increasing frequency. When I finally consulted a specialist, I was told I had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, which would progressively rob me of all muscle strength, eventually making me a helpless quadriplegic, unable to speak and, when my diaphragm ceased to move, unable to breathe. Death generally occurs within 2 to 5 years for those diagnosed with ALS. There is no effective treatment. There is no cure. It was shocking. I didn't really feel sick. It was infuriating. I didn't feel ready to die. It was devastating for my family as my physical decline progressed. This disease is all about loss. We had to give up our home. Someone in a wheelchair couldn't live in a narrow 5-story house filled with stairs. The law practice I had loved and nurtured evaporated. I tried to focus on my husband and children, to be sure they understood that they were and always had been the most important parts of my life. But my frustration and sadness were hard for them to understand and to accept. I often seemed a different person. 4 years after my diagnosis, my breathing had become so compromised that it was clear the end was near. But unlike with cancer or heart disease, I had an alternative. My muscles didn't work, but I was otherwise healthy. This meant that if I chose to, I could go on a ventilator and be fed through a tube. I could continue to live. I wasn't ready to give up. So, 5 years ago...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?